Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I am Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and joining me today is the first repeat guest in the short history of the podcast, sports writer for The Nation, book author, Edge of Sports radio host, frequent television pundit, razor-sharp thinker on all things sports and politics, and a good friend of the show, Mr. Dave Zirin. Dave, how are you?
Wow, I'm honored. I had no idea I was the first twofer. Very proud about that.
We're gonna have you back again, so you might be like sort of the is it Alec Baldwin? Who's the person that, or Steve Martin, that hosts Saturday Night Live like a dozen
times?
Five
times club. Justin there you go. Timberlake, Alec Baldwin, Paul Simon, Steve Martin. Well, who else? There's somebody hilarious. Oh yeah, Elliot Gould. That one was a bit of a surprise.
Well, of course, who could forget Elliot Gould? Mm. Actually, underrated, but. Yeah, we'll shoot to get you on more than that. I'm presuming they keep giving me the podcast.
So Candace Bergen also. She was the only woman.
Really? Murphy, yes. Brown. How about that? So I wanted to have you on to talk about Sochi. Yep. And we'll get there in a minute. But since we are taping on a Monday, which is the day after the Super Bowl, I have to ask you this first. Last night, Super Bowl, even by NFL standards, by Super Bowl standards, there was so much America. I mean, we had the pregame Declaration of Independence, Stars and Stripes slipped into the halftime show, that really weird Bob Dylan car commercial. I mean, there was so much America that, well, there was that 24 reboot commercial where they were shooting up the British flag. I thought that was just some sort of nod to the Revolutionary War. What did you make of all the, like, patriotism last night?
Well, I mean, it's less about the patriotism. I just wrote a column about this today. I mean, it's less about the patriotism and more the way patriotism, the military, the NFL, and even Budweiser all mixed together to be this one kind of montage, pastiche, stew of, I don't know, bombast. I mean, I thought it was kind of scandalous. I mean, you have this young man, this lieutenant, who comes back and has a surprise ticker tape parade for him in his hometown, put on by Budweiser. He's even in the Budweiser red wagon with the Clydesdales pulling him through his town. And then the very next shot, as soon as the commercial ends, he's sitting in the stands at the Super Bowl. And you see the way there's this beneficial relationship between the National Football League and the U.S. military. And of course, both of them, you know, cloak themselves as much as possible in the red, white, and blue. I mean, it's a way of presenting a very unnuanced view of what the sports and what the military actually is. And, you know, one of the people I interviewed for my article was Mary Tillman, the mother of Pat Tillman. And believe it or not, this April, it's going to be 10 years since Pat Tillman, the NFL player turned Army Ranger, was killed in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And, yeah, can you believe that?
No.
10 years. And I want to read to you what she said to me.
Please, please.
She's such a smart person. I mean, she said to me, I don't like that all the ads of the military are shown on TV. A feeling of camaraderie is important to all humans, and I do think that the camaraderie that sports provides brings the most reward. Many young men join the military in order to get that feeling of belonging, that feeling of brotherhood, and it is irresponsible to try to entice young people into the military with subliminal messages. And the subliminal message, of course, she's talking about is like basically, you know, that same jolt of adrenaline that you feel on Sundays when you watch the NFL, that's something that you're going to reproduce. Except you're going to be Marshawn Lynch, and instead of holding a football, you're going to be holding an M16. And that's a very false picture of what military service actually is. And it's interesting because we've made such strides in recent years, Patrick, and frankly, you deserve some serious credit for this, but we've made such strides in recent years of exposing the actuality of life for former NFL players, and it's gotten a ton of media attention. And I still feel like we lag dramatically behind that, though, and finding out what life is actually like for people who served in Afghanistan and Iraq when they come home.
I'm glad you brought that up, and this is something that would take its own podcast, but I want to mention this really quickly. It's something I've been learning more about, and I hope to work on more this year. You know, if you look at sort of how the NFL has approached brain damage and brain trauma, this kind of denialist attitude, and basically a way of avoiding having to pay the costs of it. That's small, but it seems big, but compared to what's happened at the military and the Pentagon and the Department of Defense in the last 10 years, the NFL is small potatoes. There's a lot of, and there's been some really good reporting at places like ProPublica about this, but there have been some serious problems with diagnosing, treating, acknowledging the huge amount of TBI that we're seeing in soldiers that have been serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that's like the signature injury of these wars now. And, again, not to derail this whole podcast, I just think that's something people listening, I encourage everybody, go out there and read about this because it'll be eye-opening. And the next time you see the NFL partnering with the Defense Department for some sort of ballyhooed study on brain trauma, you might want to think twice about what's actually happening there.
Well, and I have no doubt that they really are combining their research. They really are trying to work together in the fact that they both deal with these similar issues of TBI and using the NFL's financial might with the Army's, just I'm sure just warehouses filled with data to try to figure it out. What I find so disgraceful, Patrick, is the way this is kept from the public. And I mean, it's just like it's one of those things where I don't understand how you can have a democracy without informed consent. So if people are going to join the military, then by all means go for it, but go in eyes wide open as far as the actuality of what it is. Don't do it because of what the commercials tell you it is. Similarly, don't let your kid play football because of what you think football is. Let them play football for because of what it actually is. And you just see this interlocking propaganda that frankly really does help both of them a great deal. It makes the NFL look good. It makes them look like they're supporting the troops and are patriotic, and it makes the military look good because it aids their recruitment in a profound fashion. And yet, I mean, Jesus, who's more of a voice of authority on this than Mary Tillman? I mean, how many families have had to deal with both of those worlds? And because her other son as well was in the Army Rangers, Kevin, who was also an athlete, he was a baseball player. And so it's like she's very aware of the pros and cons of sports and very aware of really the cons of military life. And I think her words need to be taken to heart that these things, it's probably healthier for society if they're delinked.
I'm glad. I'm actually really glad you contacted her because in the opening montage with the Declaration of Independence, there was a quick shot of the Pat Tillman statue outside Arizona Cardinals Stadium, and all I thought to myself is like, from what I know of Pat Tillman, and again, I didn't know him personally, but everything I've read and learned about him, he would have been very dubious of all the sort of propaganda that was being thrown out last night.
Oh,
And he was a guy who was a true patriot. I'm not trying to say, I mean, he was a really patriotic person in the truest sense of the word. And I think he would have totally at least arched an eyebrow at what was being thrown on television.
Pat was subtle as a blowtorch. He would have said, "This is complete bullshit, and I want no fucking part of my face being a part of this." Remember, if Pat Tillman had wanted to, he could have been the face of the Army Rangers, but he really dropped out of sight after he joined until his death. You didn't hear too much about him. You didn't know what he was doing. And that was because that was the way he wanted it. That was certainly not the way the Pentagon wanted it.
I mean, again, we could try to talk about this the whole time, but I'll just close this sort of idea of this thought, which is the old saying, patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. I personally got a little whiff of that. It seemed like, more than usual, the NFL was just wrapping itself really hard in the flag. And again, it's great to acknowledge the military. It's good to support what they're doing for society. I don't think there's any problem with that. I don't think anyone find a problem with that. But I think there's a fine line between doing that and then appropriating the good feelings we as a society have towards the military for your own sort of commercial and image uses. And I think that's where the NFL kind of goes over the line quite a bit.
And what about to sell Budweiser too?
Oh yeah, that's a whole other thing,
I mean,
which I
that was,
think.
I called it in my article, the triple Lindy of product placement, and that you had Budweiser, the NFL, and the military all in one shot. And it immediately to me raises moral questions about alcoholism in the military, you know, about
right.
a whole host of issues about like, okay, so how is Budweiser now a part of this deal? It's like I get the mutually beneficial relationship of the NFL and the Pentagon. Now Budweiser?
Right.
Okay. Great.
Keep I mean, maybe we can going. Put Budweiser patches on our military uniforms.
Yeah.
It's all that space. I don't know. Well, let's go to Sochi. That's coming up. It's starting the end of this week. A lot is going on. I want to know in your mind what the biggest story is here. I'm going to list a few of the different big things.
Yeah.
We've got allegations and evidence of massive widespread corruption. We've got Russia's stridently anti-gay policies and politics. We've got a very real terrorist threat, yes. which is in turn yes. very rooted in Russian and regional politics and conflict. We've got Putin. So we've got his whole ego and image and political power tied up in this. And we just have the incredible actual dollar/ruble, whatever you want to call it, expense that has gone into hosting these games and what that might say about sports mega events and spectacles in general. Of all those things, what's the biggest one to you? Or can you not tease them out?
Good Lord. Yeah. I mean, I think the number one story is that Sochi is like every Olympics, except all of the critiques of mega events have been magnified dramatically by Vladimir Putin's hubris and ego and the unfettered greed of the IOC. So on the one hand, you have to understand Sochi is part of a continuum where you have the budget-busting projects, you have the hyper-militarization, you have the stoking up of terrorism fears, and you have the attacking of the most vulnerable in society, either for the purposes of displacement to build facilities or just for the purposes of you've enacted basically martial law and you do it because you need to clean up your town for the purposes of the international audience. Now, these factors I just mentioned are true to greater or lesser degrees in every Olympics. It's just that this one is spiked with Vladimir Putin's hubris. So not only – that's what it's all spinning around. So not only do you have everything I just mentioned, you have the fact that Vladimir Putin is saying, I am going to remake an entire war-torn region of the country and use the Olympics to do it. And so therefore, people might know the stories. You know, estimates range from $50 to $66 billion for these Olympics.
I mean, that's like
they'll
basically
be the most expensive in history.
Isn't that basically more expensive than every other Winter Olympics combined?
It is. No, those figures are stone cold. It's they're more than every Winter Games combined, and they're more than the Beijing Olympics, which were the previous king of that dubious honor. And now what's so crazy about that, of course, is that it's a hell of a lot more expensive to put on the summer games than
sure.
it is winter games.
And it's not like China spared any expense last time around.
Yeah,
here.
They certainly did not. And I remember people at the time remarking about like, wow, will any country ever best this? And Putin basically did it with one corrupt hand tied behind his back. The individual stories are punchy enough, worth telling. Old cronies of Putin who got 21 government contracts. These are like boyhood friends of his worth $7 billion. Wow. No one really knows what they did with the money. The one road from Olympic Village to the top of the ski mountain is going to cost more than the entire Vancouver Games.
Amazing.
It's $8.7 billion. If you had coated it with a centimeter of beluga caviar, it would cost less than $8.7 billion. I mean, that's just a way to illustrate just how incredible it is. And then, of course, amidst this just orgy of corruption, amidst the literal disappearance of $30 billion from the Olympic projects. And I use the word literally, like the money was there for the Olympics and then it wasn't there anymore.
It's like Alakazam.
Yeah, it's like that stupid movie with Jesse Eisenberg and Michael Caine, where they're all the Woody Harrelson, where they're all the magicians.
Right.
They make those big things disappear. Amidst all of that, like you get basically Vladimir Putin doing the, hey, you know, the real problem here is these gays. I mean,
right.
I don't see this. I mean, Vladimir Putin has been in power in Russia for quite a few years at this point, and he picks the last year to push this through the Russian parliament with a 436-0 vote. I mean, I don't think he in any way, shape, or form expected the level of international solidarity and attention to the anti-gay laws. I don't think that was on his agenda. But I do certainly think that you only really push those kinds of laws, which have no basis in reality, the gay propagation law, you know, like no right. basis in reality, and get every single damn member of parliament to vote for it. You don't get something like that unless you're trying to draw people's attention away from something else.
So you think all this anti-gay stuff, and I'm not trying to make light of it because it's terrible, but you think at some political level this is an okey-doke?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, I do. I do. And, you know, once again, it's like, to be very clear, it's like that doesn't mean the homophobia isn't real. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the effect on people's lives isn't real. And that doesn't mean there aren't very real zealots inside the Russian Duma who weren't like, thank God, I've been waiting for this. Just like if there was an okey-doke in this country, say, to bomb Iran, there are, of course, people in the Congress who've wanted to bomb Iran for years.
Or to bring up all sorts of, anti-gay marriage laws in various swing states in a
for example
an election that potentially could have taken place in the mid-2000s, possibly masterminded by the chief political strategist to the fictional hypothetical president of the United States.
Yeah, only to take one example. Yes,
exactly. A totally hypothetical example.
So it's like, you know, it's like and also okey-dokes only work if there's a political basis of support for them. Like you can't – like right. My favorite screwed up okey-doke was in the middle of dissent about the Iraq war. Remember George W. Bush at the State of the Union is like, we're going to go to Mars.
Oh, I remember that. What happened to Mars? I wanted to go to Mars. I was behind that. Where's my Mars?
Patrick, you were alone on that island, which is why you're a visionary. But most people were like, get the troops out of Solder City. Stop talking about Mars. So, you know, okey-dokes have to be politically savvy. And I think with Putin...
I thought we were going to launch the Mars mission from Iraq. I thought that was the whole point.
Oh, man.
Are you telling me it was about oil?
There's oil on Mars. But there's this idea that that I think the okey-doke has been successful nationally in Russia, from what I hear, from people I've talked to, Russian experts, all the rest of it. The editor where I work, Katrina Vandenhoevel, she just got back from Russia, spoke to her about it mm-hmm. at length. It's successful inside of Russia, but it's been, of course, a disaster internationally and threatens to overshadow the games, the fact that there are going to be very real acts of protest and resistance that happen during the games. So it's just impossible to de-link all of the issues you named. I think the best way to understand it is it's the issues we see at every Olympics, only magnified dramatically.
Well, you mentioned the idea of protest at the games. Originally, there had been some talk of a boycott last fall. Obviously, that didn't happen. I know you're one of the people that advocated for that not to happen.
Yeah.
In favor of actual protest. The U.S., as a country, we sent a fairly symbolic Olympic delegation, did we not?
Yeah, and I thought that was really problematic, too. And we should talk about that.
Real quickly, let people know, you know, what was the delegation and what did you find problematic about it?
Sure. It was four members of the delegation: Billie Jean King, Caitlin Cahow, Brian Boitano, and Bonnie Blair. Mm-hmm. Three of those people are very esteemed Winter Olympians. And one of those people, Billie Jean King, is, of course, you know, a sports and politics protest legend. Billie Jean King and Caitlin Cahow also – not only members of the LGBT community, but also people who are political activists mm-hmm. on this question. And then, of course, Brian Boitano comes out of the closet after he's named mm-hmm. To the group. So all of that, very significant.
So in essence, a diplomatic middle finger.
Yes, or thumb to the eye, if you will. And middle finger works too.
Middle finger also, to the eye. How about that?
Yes, and also this –
you can get deeper with a finger than a thumb.
That's true. I believe for the first time since 2000 that no member of the president's or vice president's family or the president or vice president themselves for that matter mm-hmm. went to an Olympic Games. So huge deal. Nobody from the president or vice president's family and three of the four people are LGBT.
Right.
All of that is a huge deal. Now, what's problematic about that? Well, two things are problematic about it. I mean, first, on the most like on the level of what's in the best interests of LGBT people in Russia, we got to start there, because any action that takes place in Sochi has to have an eye on what happens to the people who actually have to live there.
Right.
When the cameras go home, when the Olympics go home. And in any consideration of any protest by any Olympian has to have one eye on that fact. And when Obama sticks a thumb in Putin's eye like this, and let's be honest, it is a selective thumb, because India just passed a series of anti-LGBT laws. No word from Obama about that. So why about Russia? Of course, there's a whole host of diplomatic conflicts with Russia on everything from the Middle East, Syria, trade, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Not friendly times with Putin's Russia.
Right.
And so what that allows, and President Obama is very aware of this, what this allows is for Vladimir Putin to paint not just the delegation, which of course is a political act and an explicit one, as Obama said in the State of the Union address, but paint the protesters themselves in Russia as pawns of the United States.
Right. These are foreign agitators, Carl.
Yes, or under the influence of foreign agitators. And this is about Russian sovereignty. And you paint it in all these other kinds of issues. And I got to tell you, what's so frustrating about it is President Obama during the Arab Spring, you know, there were people who were saying that the U.S. should send in troops to help Mubarak. And then there were other people who said the U.S. should send in troops to help depose Mubarak in Egypt.
But the answer was always troops. Troops, troops, troops.
Yeah, and President Obama said, and I, first of all, let me be clear, I have no doubt that there were surreptitious things going on in Egypt, but as far as like an explicit public military kind of intervention, President Obama said several really smart things, like if you send in troops, what that allows is for the forces of repression to say this is a U.S. stooge move.
Right.
And it sometimes these things need to happen organically. So he's like very aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he does this, what he undercuts is two things. One is the organic process of the movement in Russia. The other is the idea of this being an international protest against Russian laws. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is really shaping up to being, is athletes from a bunch of different countries wearing rainbow pins, ribbons, what have you, once over there. So that gets undercut by this delegation. So the second reason, and this is – I mean, so that's a very concrete sort of grassroots critique of what he's doing. The more political critique is, you know, we live in a country where it's legal to fire people for being gay in 29 states. You know, President Obama did not mention ENDA, which would be a federal law that prevented that kind of discrimination in the State of the Union.
So you think there's a glass house element here too?
There is a glass house, and there's also a kind of, hey, look at the shiny dangling thing over here while I do nothing over there.
Sort of a domestic of Yudok.
Yes, it's safe to attack Russia because one thing that does – even Glenn Beck has said things against the LGBT policies in Russia.
Wow.
Like it's safe to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much less safe to say employers shouldn't have the right to fire people because they're gay, and which Obama believes, but he's not agitating for.
Bringing that back home, and then like bringing it back to Sochi for a second, because you did mention a second ago, we're going to see athletes protesting this to some degree in some way, and it's going to be international. Do you have any sense for specifically what we might see? I mean, look, you wrote a book of John Carlos. I don't know if it's going to be the kind of thing where there's going to be some sort of indelible John Carlos, Tommy Smith moment at these games, or are we going to see a bunch of things happening? I mean, do you have any sense for...
Yeah, I do. I've heard, I'll be honest with you, Patrick, I've heard both rumors from people who are very connected to it, and I've heard that are utterly unsubstantiated. So, and passing on those rumors would be bad on two fronts. One, you know, I'm a journalist, I could be telling you something that's not true. And two, if I say something that I think could happen, that could mean I could be putting the people who are planning it either at risk of getting it smashed, or even worse. I mean, this would be the most depressing thing. If I tell you something that could be true, but because I open my big yap,
Russia
preemptively stops it, and then nothing happens. And then that would really suck.
We want to report the news, not make the news, right? The old journalism thing.
Yeah, report the news, not make the news. And so the, but what I can report clearly is that people are going there. There's enough people going there that if everybody does what they want to do, there's not going to be one moment. Just like honestly, in 1968, there wasn't just one moment.
Right.
Athletes did several things on the field, but that's the only one we remember. That being said, it is worth saying that 1968, it was the first Olympics that were ever broadcast worldwide in Technicolor. It was a time where people only had what, three channels. And so the idea of that kind of like national moment of protest, I think people are probably shooting too high if they want something like Tommy Smith and John Carlos. And then there's the last thing too, which I think is really different, is let's remember that John Carlos and Tommy Smith did not go to Mexico City to criticize Mexico.
No.
They went there to criticize the United
That
States.
helps.
Yeah, so it's like to go to Russia to criticize Russia at a time when Russia is, at loggerheads with the United States.
It's a
I mean,
little
it may
riskier.
very well get these particular athletes blacklisted from the Olympic movement. That's very possible.
Right. Oh, we're not going to see the IOC stand behind athletes, are
No,
we?
we are not. But it won't make them sort of like dead to rights when they come home the way Smith and Carlos were.
Sure. Times have changed a little bit on that front. And like you said,
Yeah.
they're not protesting the US.
They're not protesting the U.S. That's, I think, one, times have changed. You're absolutely right about that. But it's also that, people are going there to raise hay about something that's viewed internationally as a problem and one that dovetails with policy in the United States towards Russia.
Well, it comes back to the patriotism and tribalism we've been talking about. You mentioned Putin also. And you said how a lot of this is almost like he's like the magnetic center of all this. He's the radioactive core here. In what way are these games almost like for him personally, like sort of an exercise in political branding for himself? Because I think of his ridiculous shirtless bear wrestling action hero photo ops, and I almost feel like these games are the ultimate version of that. But I don't
Sure.
know.
No, that's exactly right. And it goes together with everything because another one of Putin's staples has been his merciless approach to the Chechen War, which remember, this was started under Yeltsin, 20 years, 160,000 people killed. So this entire thing has been an act of hubris. Like this is like his victory dance on the graves of the Chechens.
And these games are not that far from Chechnya, or what are they, 200 miles away, 250 miles away, something like that?
No, they're very close, and they encompass the region of the war zone too. That's the key thing, is that, and so that's why like there's all this, and that's the other thing too, Patrick. I have to say, so many Olympics, there have been absolute BS terror concerns
Right.
that mean nothing. This is not one of those times.
No, it's real this
This
time.
is real terror concerns, and I mean, I think that there's got to be some accountability on Putin's shoulders for the fact that, and the IOC, that they could have put these Olympics anywhere, even somewhere with snow, and they chose to put them in this subtropical climate because Putin's ego and Putin's, frankly, bank account said that they could do it.
What happens to Putin, to the IOC, if something big goes wrong? And I guess I'm thinking terrorism, but just if something else could, what if it, something's built shoddily and falls apart? What if there's all these, I mean, what if a bunch of things happen? If this doesn't go well, is that going to be bad for him domestically?
Domestically, no. Internationally, he actually has developed a great deal of prestige recently. I think it would hurt. Unfortunately, I don't think it would do anything to the IOC. I mean, and the great tragedy of this is that we've been there. We've been there. We've lived through Munich in 72. We've lived through Turin when the luge was so unsafe, it like destroyed people's lives. I mean, these things have happened in the past. Corruption has happened in the past. It
We had that in
tends,
Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake City, it tends not to do anything. And if there's, to the Olympics, I should say. But could it hurt Putin? Of course it could hurt Putin. I mean, I think that it's already hurt Putin, frankly.
I mean, it does seem like he's putting a big bet on this,
Oh,
kind of in every way.
and he's already partially lost it. I mean, the recent terror attacks. Which is nothing, obviously, anybody would cheerlead, but it's a symbol of the fact that the region was not nearly as quiet or as pacified as he was leading people to believe.
I want to ask you a media question about all of this, which is basically, you know, NBC, they pay a lot of money for the Olympics. They sell a lot of advertising against them. A lot of very wealthy corporations are heavily invested in the games. And you know, when I say that, they're invested in the feel-good sports part of the games, the part we're not actually talking about in this podcast. But that makes it also compelling programming. How do you expect NBC, and I don't just mean their Olympic broadcast, but MSNBC, their nightly news, you know, sort of their newsy divisions, to cover all these things we're talking about? Are they going to get a fair shake? Are they going to get kind of brushed over? How do they deal with that when, you know, they're simultaneously trying to, you know, make a buck off of covering this sports event, but this sports event is so wrapped up in all these bigger picture and unsavory kinds of things?
Well, I wish I had this bit of information off the top of my head, but I don't. But in previous Olympics, MSNBC's coverage was preempted to show Olympic coverage. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, of course, it gives – you know, they then don't have to deal with this question.
Right.
It's another non-starter because they're just showing the Olympics. But, you know, but this is something I have spoken to Bob Costas about. Like, he expects to talk about this.
He's not put in a tough spot. I would feel like he would be because he's kind of trying to serve two masters in a way.
Yeah. I mean, he also is somewhat, you know, bulletproof too. I mean, mm-hmm. he's Bob Costas and he believes, you know, very strong. I mean, people can have critiques of how he does it or how often he does it, but he really does think that, that this is space to raise some of these issues, you know, at least, with a subtle hand. Like, it's not about, it's not the way I would do it, but I think it's a way that when he does do it, I'm not going to be one of those people who's like, sure, he talked about it for a minute, but why not for 5 minutes, you right. know, whatever. It's like, I think any effort
is better than no effort.
Yeah, because you got to pull back the curtain a little bit on this. I mean, it would be denying too much. And I know that there are people who really do wish NBC had done more, for example, around human rights when the Olympics were in Beijing. Mm-hmm. I mean, people inside NBC who wish they'd do more. And once again, it's like because the United States is at loggerheads with Russia, it opens up an opportunity. Like, it provides a little more breathing room from what the number one problem is in mainstream media, which is self-censorship. Not censorship, but self-censorship.
Right.
And it provides just a little more space.
Not wanting to sort of tick off the people that pay your bills, essentially, in the mainstream media.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's a very real conflict for a lot of people that are in media, and I don't know if there's an easy solution to it. Again, that's probably its own podcast. To be fair here, and you mentioned this at the top of the show right now, Sochi is not the first mega sporting event to have all these kinds of problems. And it definitely won't be the last.
No.
I don't think you can.
Brazil this summer.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I mean, I don't think you can have an Olympics or a World Cup without rampant bribery. The same is true with, you know, like Olympic bids always have bribery. The building costs always go way over budget. There's always all sorts of kickbacks that are responsible for that. I mean, I went to Greece for the Athens games. I think they're still paying off those games. The countries never seem to get much out of it. 10 years later, it's with a bunch of rotting, empty stadiums. So, you know, like you said, Rio, Brazil, we're seeing all sorts of problems. We're seeing all sorts of protests. Qatar, we're seeing bribery. We're seeing basically slavery and indentured servants using to build these facilities. We're seeing the ridiculous idea of holding the World Cup in the summer in the middle of the desert.
They're going to hold it in the winter.
Oh, they're going to move that now, right? They're changing it now, right? I mean, you know, these events, they do make for great TV. The sports themselves are really thrilling. And the off-screen costs often are really hideous. Are we, and I mean this, we as in like all of us, like internationally, like as a planet almost, are we at the point where we need to rethink these kinds of mega sports events?
Yes, absolutely. Jesus Christ, that was 40 years ago. We needed to rethink them. And we need to keep doing it. And we need to keep raising our voices about this. Like, to me, the answer is pretty obvious. Like, if we want to keep having these events, and there certainly does seem to be an appetite for them, and I do like seeing sports that are sort of off the beaten track of just like the same sports all the time. You know what I'm saying? Like you get a little bit of variety is nice, but the way to do it would be to have one continual spot and not shift locations. And it would cut against a lot of the problems. Obviously, nothing is foolproof. It's not like there wouldn't be problems, but at the very least would cut against a lot of the issues that we've been discussing.
What if we even had a rotation of 4 or 5 spots, like the way
That would
the
work
college
too.
bowls do? And
I
we could
think
at least we
that
could
would
cut
work too.
down some of the corruption. We can't get rid of all of it, but we could shave it, give it a haircut.
Yeah, no, I think that would absolutely work too. I mean, I think anything that just cuts against the whole bidding process, I mean, that's the root of a lot of the evil.
Right.
So you get rid of the bidding process, you get rid of world leaders showing up in Lausanne, hat in hand, begging for the Olympic neoliberal Trojan horse. Just do that. And then I think we'd be in a very good place.
The Olympic neoliberal Trojan horse. You've talked about that on the podcast before. Love that term.
Yeah, man. That's every time you say it, you owe me 35 cents.
Does the Candyman, if I say it in front of the mirror 3 times, will he appear behind me? Okay, I know that you're running low on time. So, last question here. It's a non-Sochi question, but there was big news last week. Northwestern football players attempting to unionize. To you, why is that significant? And how do you think that fits into the bigger picture of basically what we see, amateurism under siege in college sports?
I thought you were about to ask me about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm serious. Like with that last
Well,
question.
to me, this was the big news from last week.
Yeah, man. Philip Seymour Hoffman. That depresses the hell out of me.
Great,
All
great
right.
actor.
Here's a
No, me
question.
too.
I think it's huge, because what it does is, I mean, my God, I'm about to quote you back to you, Patrick, which
That's
is a little
great.
weird.
Then we're just going to dissolve into the vortex. This is going to be an event horizon here.
Yeah, seriously. Like this is like a sign of the apocalypse. We're just going to quote each other back to each other until it's like the computer explodes. But something that you wrote, which I totally agree with, is that it solves the problem of labor power, which is the only power that athletes have. Is if college athletes decided not to take the field, all of these fictitions, all of this fiction would get washed away. And the NCAA would be forced to actually give athletes what they need, which is a seat at the table. Yet for a lot of athletes, risking that is just it's just historically been proven to be too tall an order.
Yeah.
But so organizing as a union where, the old slogan in the union movement is we prepare to strike so we don't have to strike. I mean, if you put athletes in these bodies that allow them to actually have a seat at the table and to have at least the unspoken threat of a strike and shutting off that money, then I think it solves the number one problem, which is that all of these decisions get made at the NCAA level without input from so-called student
You know,
athletes.
it's government without the consent of the governed.
Yeah.
It's like the most un-American thing ever.
Yeah.
It's what we have here in D.C., by the way, taxation without representation, but that's another
Yeah.
podcast as well.
But this is so interesting, though, because it's like Northwestern could recognize the union post haste if they wanted to. If the NLRB approves it, Northwestern would be fine with it. But what a lot of people don't talk about is like Northwestern has a vested interest in not recognizing them because the grad students at Northwestern aren't unionized.
Right.
And it opens up the door for a lot of other groups on campus to be like, well, where's our frickin' union? And so that's their interest in not doing it.
And
But of
they
course, they
also
have
have
to
the
give
interest
the
of,
excuse of the NCAA and
oh, sure.
saying, well, it's a cartel. And if we recognize you and the NCAA doesn't like it, that means we're out of the cartel.
Yeah, they're going to lose all that sweet Big Ten network money. So there's another, they actually have a tangible financial reason there,
Yeah, it's
too.
not just an existential concern.
Sure. Well, look, Dave, we could go on,
Philip
but
Seymour Hoffman, man.
and you know what? A real, I mean, somebody who basically became a big enough star, I think that as soon as he's on the screen, you know it's him, but 5 minutes later you completely forget it's him. He always
Exactly.
inhabited every role, which I think to me, not being someone who is like really, I know nothing about acting, but to me as someone who just is in the audience, when the actors can inhabit the role, to me, is always a sign of someone that's really good at what they do.
No, I agree with that too. I think that's a very good point because it's like he had this ability to imbue every line in a way that was memorable. So you think about, like, to me, my favorite performances by him are in a lot of ways his smallest parts.
Mm-hmm.
Like he had the bit part in Boogie Nights, the bit part in Talented Mr. Ripley, the bit part in Happiness, even the bit part when he was only 22, 23 years old and was in Scent of a Woman and was one of the, you know, just like the most snotty kids who was trying to railroad Chris O'Donnell.
Right.
He just, the look of humiliation on his face when Al Pacino is just ripping him for hiding in daddy's big pockets in that famous, you know, speech he gives at the end. I mean, Pacino is hamming it up and overacting, and it's frankly embarrassing as hell. There was a time I could see, you know. I stop talking. It's like the old guy at the club. And then it goes to Philip Seymour Hoffman's face, and he looks like he's kind of wetting himself with humiliation, with just like in just one facial expression. I mean, just
right.
It's just too much talent for one man. I mean, it's very sad. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to. I mean, addiction is really difficult. I mean, once you're addicted, I mean, especially things like heroin. I mean, what they do to your brain, it is not an easy thing to quit, to try to quit, to stay quit. Very difficult.
Yeah,
and not really an issue of willpower so much as chemistry.
You know. I can't even say for sure if it was heroin, but I
mean, that was what was reported. I don't know if that
– No, for him, I mean, sure. It was definitely heroin, but – oh, no, it was heroin. I looked it up as I was talking so I could tell you this story. I interviewed Chris Herron, you know, the former basketball mm-hmm. player.
Yeah, absolutely.
Long Beach State high school legend out of Massachusetts. And I interviewed him about how he kicked his drug habit, and yes, it was heroin. And one of the things he said was like Chris Mullen took him into his house, and Chris Mullen and his wife literally just kept him there for weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that's the kind of intensity we're talking about. Like a week in rehab is not going to do it.
No, not at all. I mean, it's so much more powerful, the way it alters your brain chemistry. I mean, especially these kind of drugs. I mean, heroin – again, not to get on a whole soapbox here, but heroin, you know, is basically chemically the same as some of these really powerful prescription painkillers we have. They're all opioids, and they act in the brain the same way. And then, you know, that's why those opioids are, you know, that's the biggest sort of addiction problem we have growing in America right now. It's you know, it's not necessarily street drugs. It's a prescription painkillers. So in a way, I mean, you know, in a way, not to bring us back to sports, but in a way, what he was probably dealing with heroin is not too dissimilar from what former athletes are dealing with Vicodin, Percocet, things like that.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Probably speaks to just sort of the more, you know, we all need to have a little more empathy, sympathy, and sort of, hopefully in terms of policy, put a little more money into trying to help people, trying to help them get treatment. Like you said, serious treatment, like serious intervention. Lasting intervention, not just here's you know, a week or 2 weeks or a month in rehab and be on your way.
Man, I don't know what that was.
I don't know either. But I think it might be the NSA.
If it is, it is.
Well, look, I've kept you too long here. Do you have a last thought?
No. Yeah. Just about what you're saying. Like, it always comes down to then, like, who's going to pay for it?
Of course it does.
And it's that's one of the things that's so maddening about our times, frankly, because you do see, I mean, the capacity of wealth for spectacle, for Sochi.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, so it's less a question about is there enough money and more a question about what our
what do you want? Yeah. What do you want to spend it on? That's always the question, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, look, on that depressing note.
Happier note. I can see, you know. I don't know. I thought maybe if I did a Pacino, it would help.
No, I mean, you made me laugh, but
I've been around, man. Okay, sorry.
That's all right. I'm sure. Yeah, the dozen listeners that have stuck to this point, they probably just tuned out, but that's all right.
Hey, Patrick, you want to hear something pretty badass?
Yeah.
I'm not the best prognosticator in the world, but I've picked the last two Super Bowl winners before the start of the season.
Really?
That's pretty badass.
All of two.
That's pretty bad, isn't it? Two for two the last 2 years before the season even began.
How many years before that did you not pick it correctly?
I didn't do so well because I was picking the Ravens like every year for 5 years.
So you're two for five.
Well, if you want to go back that
That's,
far.
you know what, though? I mean, look, that's 400. That'd be good if we're talking about hitting a baseball.
That's true. But I prefer to look at it as I'm two for my last two. I'm on a hot streak.
This is why, if we go into a casino, you are going to walk out way up or way down.
No,
I'm
going to
be just fine.
I've been to many a casino. I don't hit the tables because I don't have the personality for it.
That's good.
It's
you
just
know yourself.
A bad scene. It's like, know thyself. You
it's
know what
very,
I'm saying?
It's very Socratic.
Know thyself. And myself would be, my kids are going to be, you know, eating out of a dish with water and crumbs. I mean, I would lose it all, man.
The house always wins. I mean, that's the problem with casino. That's why they're huge. That's
yeah.
why they're luxurious.
That is true.
Well, look, like I said, we're out of time. But before we go, where can people find your writing, and how can they find you on Twitter?
Yeah, no problem. At Edge of Sports for the Twitter. And you can find my writing at the Nation Magazine site or go to edgeofsports.com, where I try and often fail to catalog all my stuff.
Dave Zirin, thank you again. It's always a pleasure. Everybody, make sure you check Dave out. Go to Twitter. Go to the Nation. Go to Edge of Sports. Listen to him on satellite radio. Or just tune on MSNBC. He's on there like every day. So,
man, you better come on my show soon. Haven't had you on in a minute.
Anytime. I'll be down there. Love to.
All right. I'll be in touch with you then.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for a final thought, everyone out there, America, just because.
Just because.
Yeah. Like, it's good enough for the Super Bowl. Good enough
Wait,
for us.
Is it America or Bud America? Because after last night, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Bud America. That works
Bud
for
America.
Me.
Bud America. That's also copyrighted.
Also,
say
also
that,
by
I get
the way,
17 cents.
Also, by the way, people should note Budweiser, owned by InBev, you know, a Brazilian / Dutch mega conglomerate. So
that's true.
You're not really buying American anymore, and you buy Bud. But, you know, keep watching the Clydesdales and the puppies. anyway.
That's a dark way to end this, but have a good one, Patrick.
You too. Until the next podcast, I am Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth. Saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.